for autistic people, both are trudging. Unlike deafness, autism has not been established as a culture in the eyes of even the liberal outside world. There is no formal language of autism to be recognized by linguists. There is no university with a long history of educating autistic people, unless one counts MIT. Institutions parallel to those that subtend the deaf claim to culture, deaf theater, deaf social habits, deaf clubs, are not in place for autistics. The complexity of the science means that autism has time before medical progress trumps identity politics. But the deaf model should make it clear to the neurodiversity crowd that they are in a race in which their primary advantage is the other side's tortoise-like pace. The autistic have on their side as well, however, the very real achievements of autistic people. Retrospective diagnosis, albeit shaky science, suggests that Mozart, Einstein, Hans Christian Andersen, Thomas Jefferson, Isaac Newton, and a great many other visionaries would now be diagnosed on the spectrum. Describe a world without Helen Keller, and most people wouldn't miss her much. Describe a world without those particular geniuses, and everyone would be impoverished. Bill Davis grew up in the Bronx, found his way into street gangs, and then graduated into organized crime. One day in 1979, a 20-year-old would-be model walked into the nightclub he was managing. She took a carnation out of a vase, put it in my lapel, and said, "You're with me." "We've been together ever since," he said. After 10 years, Bill and Jay moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where their daughter, Jessie, was born. 5 years later, their son Christopher followed. Jay stayed home with the children. Bill tended bar. At 2, Chris stopped talking. By 2.5, he was rocking back and forth in a corner. Jay recognized that something was seriously wrong, and though she had no driver's license, she announced one morning that she was driving Chris to Philadelphia to visit the Seashore House, a children's hospital. She didn't get a satisfactory answer, so 2 days later she said, "I'm going to Kennedy Krieger in Baltimore, and if that doesn't work, we're heading down to Haddonfield, New Jersey, to the Bancroft School." Bill said, "You can't drive around without a license." The next week, she passed the test. It turned out those places were the top in the country. But when and how did she figure that out? Bill asked. And learn traffic laws at the same time? Chris didn't sleep. He flapped his hands. He injured himself. He smeared himself with feces and flung it at his parents. He bit himself. He gouged at his eyes. He stared at the ceiling fan for hours on end. Jay had intuited that Chris would need infinite patience and a progressive approach to things he found difficult, including intimacy itself. She and Bill broke everything into small tasks. It was like, "Can I touch you?" "Oh, thank you so much. You're great," Bill said. He wouldn't walk to the end of the block, so I would take him half a block and say, "What a great walk." Chris had difficulty understanding cause and effect. He liked the motion of the car and screamed every time it stopped for a red light. Jay made red and green cards, and whenever the car approached a red light, she would show him the red one, and when it was time to go, she would show him the green. Once he understood the correlation, the screaming stopped. Jay gathered that he could absorb visual information, and she came up with a system of flashcards and symbols. "I was always watching what he saw," Jay said. She had become interested in the work of Vincent Carbone, a behavior analyst, so she drove to Penn State and cornered him in his office. When he said, "Lady, I've got to go," she said, "You don't understand. I'm not letting you out of your office until you agree to help me." After resisting for an hour, he told her she could join his next course. She stayed for a week, and over the next few years developed several useful variations on his methodology. Carbone became so interested in these modifications that he sent a team up to Lancaster to observe her work with Chris. When Chris was 6, Jay started taking in other autistic children. She found that one nonverbal boy liked clocks, so she bought him clocks and praised his interest. One day, he suddenly said to himself, "Good job, Juan." It was the beginning of speech. Jay recruited interns at Franklin and Marshall College and Rutgers University to help implement her techniques, tutoring and directing them in their work at the house. She set up cameras in Chris's room and filmed the students so that she could correct their errors. She brought them to conferences and training programs. She wrote recommendation letters for them as they applied to grad school. By the time Chris was grown, Jay had trained more than 40 interns. As other families in the area became aware of her work, she placed interns with them as well. Jay refused to believe that if Chris wasn't speaking at 5, he would never do so. By the time he was 7, Chris had begun to produce words. At 10, he could speak in short sentences. Chris learned to match pictures of the American presidents to their names, and Jay made numerical games so that Chris could learn math and how to count money. When I first saw Chris's room, it was overflowing with learning materials. The beads and marbles he was using to learn to count were falling out of shoe bags. A cabinet held some 500 homemade flashcards. Musical instruments were everywhere. Shelves upon shelves held bowls of everything from coins to plastic Sesame Street monsters. In addition, perhaps 400 videotapes were piled around the room, crammed into shelves, wedged underneath and next to things, an Alexandrian library of cassettes. When a new intern started, Jay would say, "Here's $200. You're going to come into the next room where we've hidden something, and you'll try and guess what it is and where it is." The person would come into a darkened room, and all the other interns would be screaming and clicking and making nonsensical remarks. The new intern would get more and more frustrated and would finally say, "I don't understand what you're doing. What do you want?" And Jay would say, "Come on, find it, and I'll give you $200. When the person finally walked out, Jay would explain, "That's what life is like for autistic children." Bill took Jay's devotion as a challenge and took over negotiating with the state to pay for treatment. The local schools people had been confronted by emotional parents who'd say, "My son needs 40 hours of therapy." And they'd say, "Sorry, you lose," Bill recalled. I would say, "Now in Etheridge versus Collins, they hated me. But I grew up in the heartland of Irish gangs in New York. I certainly wasn't afraid of a school teacher in Lancaster." If it could be established that what Bill and Jay were doing at home was more appropriate for Chris than what the school district was offering, the district had to underwrite the program. Bill came in with an annual budget, what materials cost, what workshops cost, what the interns cost. Meanwhile, the development of therapies had become a family project. Chris's sister, Jessie, would take 2 of some instrument, a triangle say, play one under the table, and ask Chris to play the same one over it. Jay explained the mechanism of that training to Jessie. When the first district psychologist came to review the family's requests, he asked 8-year-old Jessie, "What are you doing?" She said, "Collecting sound discrimination data." The psychologist said to the district committee, "The Davises know more than I do. Just give them what they want." Still, the Davises, who had no health insurance, had a lot to pay for on their own. Chris had gymnastics, speech classes, hospital assessments, and consultations with a variety of doctors who did not take Medicaid. I was working 4 bartending jobs, bringing home sometimes $2,500 a week, Bill said. But I swear to God, we couldn't pay our rent. When things got really bad, I'd hold a bar fundraiser. I'd solicit a baseball from the Phillies. I went to the Flyers and got hockey sticks. I'd sell it all at the bar and raise $6,000 at a clip. Like many autistic people, Chris has intestinal issues. Going to the bathroom can be painful for him, and he tends to hold on for as long as possible. So his movements build up, and then movements explode behind movements, Bill said. He'll say, "Bath," and he'll hug me. I clean him and disinfect the room. My God, this is filthy. It's stacked with old movies, and he's stepping on them. And he just peed over there. It's horrible. But it's what works. The place felt at once squalid and love-imbued. Bill told me that for Jay, who had had a harsh childhood, the chance to raise her children in a perfect home had been a cherished dream. For her to let her house go, it was a real decision, he said. When Chris was 9, the Davises decided that it was time for him to enter the school system. The school district agreed to let Jay train his teachers. The one who would be in charge of his education came to their home the summer before Chris was to matriculate. She was open and very willing to learn and had kindness to her. "I knew I could work with her," Jay said. That autumn, Chris attended school in a classroom with 2 other boys, the teacher Jay had trained, and 4 assistant teachers. Soon after Chris started school, Jay began to say she was tired. She would get up at 6 a.m., go to bed at 3 a.m., Bill said. Always writing, always on the internet, always calling, always traveling. So I was surprised when she started saying, "Could you just take him?" She finally went to a doctor and found that, at age 45, she had a malignant cervical tumor the size of a grapefruit that had metastasized to her lungs and spine. One of her kidneys had shut down. She had suffered a minor heart attack, and she had lost enough blood through internal bleeding to need an emergency 5-hour transfusion. When I met Jay, she had been given a few months to live. A nurse came to the house to administer the chemotherapy Jay hoped would eke out a little more time. Even without hair, and somewhat emaciated, she was beautiful, and she had a gentleness that contrasted with Bill's machismo. She had insisted that I visit despite her condition. "I'm so lucky," she said to me, "that Chris started school. He's ready to do things on his own. Bill will make sure he gets what he needs. I always saw what he saw, but Bill feels what he feels. I've done what I came to do." The closed-circuit television system she'd set up to monitor Chris's teachers was still in place, so she could watch what happened in his room upstairs without rising. "It's just been such a strange experience for me. Everything going on at once. My dying. Chris going to school," Jay said. "I worry more about my daughter and husband than about Chris. Honestly, he's just a happy kid. But it's hard to get him to conceptualize emotions. So I'm struggling to help him understand that I won't be around." Chris had become aggressive, mostly toward Bill, whom he kept biting and punching and headbutting. But he had brought a lot of his videos downstairs, and he started curling up with them and his mother in her hospital bed. I arrived to find Jay drugged and elegiac. Chris was demanding and noisy, and kept hitting himself and other things. "Don't hit Daddy," Bill would say, smoothing Chris's irate brow with one hand and holding Jay's hand with the other. Then Chris suddenly said to Jay, in his thick voice, "I love you," and lay his head down on her chest. 10 days after I met her, on a quiet October afternoon, Jay died. She bequeathed her teaching materials to the universities where she had found help. "It won't do any good to write it all down," Bill said, "because the real thing of it is Jay herself, not anything that I could record." Shortly before Jay's death, the city of Lancaster gave her the Red Rose Award for her work. A few days later, the intermediate unit that had fought the Davises on their educational priorities announced the J. Davis Scholarships to pay for 10 families a year to attend the National Conference on Autism. Franklin and Marshall College announced the J. Davis Internship Program. Penn State announced the J. Davis Parent Scholarship. The Organization for Autism Research set up the J. Davis Memorial Award. Bill soldiered through his grief. "Our marriage changed completely the day Chris was diagnosed," he said. "We very rarely had sex. We very rarely had a closer romantic moment. If we went out to dinner, which was once a year, we would talk about Chris. Things just replaced other things. If Chris never works or marries, who cares? Let Chris be Chris. Chris taught us everything. He taught us how to deal with him, how he learned, how to let him live his life. We drove to a spot the other night that his mother and he used to go to, and he just started to cry. And I know it was because of that. My son is not a puzzle. I know exactly what he is." Bill, who had always had a taste for tattoos, started inscribing Chris's disability on his body. Bill has the word autism emblazoned across his chest, an extremely large autism puzzle ribbon, the symbol of the Autism Society of America, and the symbol for unlocking autism, a U, an A, and a key. I fell out of touch with Bill for a little while. Jay pushed Chris so hard, and when she died he said no school, Bill said when we met again. I thought, well, if what he really wants is to watch television all day, should we keep pushing him to do all these other things? Bill was charged for truancy. Pushed over the edge by Jay's medical bills, the family became homeless and lived for a while on park benches in Lancaster. 18 months after Jay died, Chris was maturing. The smearing of feces had stopped. Chris had begun to understand that the world had other rules than his, and that he must bend to them. It was almost as though the coddling attention of his demanding mother was needed to bring him out into communication, while his father's harder exigencies were needed to help him see its purpose, as if his mother gave him language and his father made him use it. I had always been skeptical of Bill's assertions about Chris's verbal abilities. He had demonstrated only occasional comprehension of a few dozen words and spoke mostly in nouns and memorized short phrases. During my last visit, I was astonished to find him typing complicated entries into a computer. While I sat there, he logged onto eBay and searched for videos. Chris actually knew many words, but he did not show an inclination to use them to connect with other people. But his capacity for emotion had grown, too. When I walked in, he began flapping his hands and making high-pitched sounds. I thought that could just be alarm, but when I sat down on the sofa, he curled up next to me. Temple Grandin once described herself as an anthropologist on Mars, a description that the neurologist Oliver Sacks appropriated as the title for one of his books. But Chris was like a Martian in a room full of anthropologists. "In case he feels everything," Bill said, "I talk to him about it all, and I love him totally and completely. Just in case." Is it neurotypical prejudice to posit that human nature entails an aspirational longing to be loved, applauded, accepted? Two diametrically opposite fictions contribute to a single set of problems. The first comes from the autism parent's literature of miracles. In its most extreme form, it describes beautiful boys and girls emerging from their affliction as if it were a passing winter frost, and, after wild parental heroics, dancing off into springtime fields of violets, fully verbal, glowing with the fresh ecstasy of unselfconscious charm. Such narratives of false hope eviscerate families who are struggling with the diagnosis. The other plotline is that the child does not get better, but the parents grow enough to celebrate him rather than seek to improve him, and are fully content with that shift. This whitewashes difficulties that many families face, and can obfuscate autism's authentic deficits. While the lives of many people who have autism remain somewhat inscrutable, the lives of people whose children have autism are mostly avowedly hard, some excruciatingly so. Social prejudice aggravates the difficulty, but it is naive to propose that it's all social prejudice. Having a child who does not express love in a comprehensible way is devastating, and having a child who is awake all night, who requires constant supervision, and who screams and tantrums but cannot communicate the reasons for or the nature of his upset. These experiences are confusing, overwhelming, exhausting, unrewarding. The problem can be mitigated by some combination of treatment and acceptance, specific to each case. It is important not to get carried away by either the impulse only to treat or the impulse only to accept. The world of disability has seen a great deal of filicide. Those who kill their autistic children usually claim that they wanted to spare those children suffering. But anyone who questions the autism rights movement has only to look at these stories to see how urgent a cause it is to argue for the legitimacy of autistic lives. In 1996, Charles Antoine Blay, age 6, was killed by his mother, who did no jail time but served 1 year in a halfway house, and then was appointed as a public representative by Montreal's Société de l'Autisme. In 1997, Casey Albury, age 17, was strangled by her mother with a bathrobe cord after refusing to jump off a bridge. Her mother said to the police, "She was a misfit. People were scared of her because she was different. I wish it could have been quicker. I'd wanted to kill her for a long time." She received a sentence of 18 months for manslaughter. In 1998, Pierre Pascu was drowned by his mother, who was given a 3-year suspended sentence. In 1999, James Joseph Cummings, Jr., at the age of 46, was stabbed to death by his father inside the residential facility where he lived. Cummings, Sr., was sentenced to 5 years in prison. That same year, Daniel Lubner, age 13, was burned alive by his mother, who was sentenced to 6 years in prison. In 2001, Gabriel Britt, age 6, was suffocated by his father, who dumped his body in a lake and then received a 4-year sentence for pleading guilty to a lesser crime. Also in 2001, Yadja Miskevich strangled her 13-year-old son, Johnny Churchy, and was sentenced to time in a psychiatric hospital. A medical examiner said she had a rigorous standard of excellence she couldn't live up to anymore. In 2003, Angelica Oriema, age 20, was drowned by her mother, Joanna, who had first attempted to electrocute her. Angelica's mother said, I worried obsessively. She served 3 years. Also that year, Terence Cottrell died of asphyxiation when his mother and other churchgoers submitted him to an exorcism. A neighbor described the mother as explaining how they held him down for almost 2 hours. He couldn't hardly breathe. Then, she said, the devil started to speak through Junior, though he can't really speak, saying, kill me, take me. She said the church told her it was the only way to heal him. She was not prosecuted. The minister who had led the exorcism was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison and fined $1,200. In 2003, Daniela Dawes strangled her 10-year-old son, Jason, and was given 5 years of probation. Her grief-stricken husband testified, until that day, she was the best mother anyone could want. In 2005, Patrick Markcrow, age 36, was suffocated by his mother, who received a 2-year suspended sentence. That same year, Jan Naylor shot her 27-year-old autistic daughter, Sarah, then set the house on fire, killing herself as well. The Cincinnati Enquirer wrote that they both died of hopelessness. In 2006, Christopher De Groot was burned to death when his parents locked him in the house and set it on fire. Each of them was sentenced to 6 months in jail. In 2006, Jose Stable slit the throat of his son, Ulysses. He called the police and said, I just couldn't take it anymore. Jose Stable served a 3.5-year sentence. In 2007, Diane Marsh killed her son, Brandon Williams, age 5. The autopsy said he had died of multiple skull fractures and an overdose of Tylenol PM tablets. His legs were covered in burn scars because his mother used to discipline him by dipping him into scalding water. She was sentenced to 10 years. In 2008, Jacob Grabe was shot by his father, who pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. As the vast majority of these sentences suggest, the habit of the courts has been to treat filicide as an understandable, if unfortunate, result of the strains of raising an autistic child. Sentences are light, and both the courtroom and the press frequently accept the murderer's profession of altruistic motives. After Zvia Lev poisoned her 16-year-old autistic son, she said, I just could not see my boy grow up slowly into a brainless man. The judge, encouraging a lenient sentence, said, her true punishment is having to live under the shadow of her crime, the memory of which will pursue her as long as she lives. About the murder of Charles Blay, the president of the Montreal Autism Society said that the murder was unacceptable but understandable. Laura Slatkin said, we've spoken to many families who say we all share that hidden dark thought. In an op-ed in the New York Times, Cammie McGovern, herself the mother of an autistic child, wrote, in mythologizing recovery, I fear we've set an impossibly high bar that's left the parents of 500,000 autistic children feeling like failures. Autistic children can make great strides, McGovern continues. But to expect complete recovery, the person your child might have been without autism, is to enter a dangerous emotional landscape, one with scope for murder. Yet altruism is a problematic word to describe acts that leave dead children in their wake. A quantitative study has shown that almost half of parents who kill a disabled child do no jail time at all. While you could kill a person who has a cold, and that would end their suffering due to their cold, a more appropriate method is to provide them medical assistance, rest, plenty of fluids, and compassion. Joel Smith, an autistic adult, has written on his blog. when a drunk driver, who does not plan the result, is sent to jail for life after killing an innocent child, surely a parent who plans a murder of her child should also get the same sentence. The dangers of seeing disability entirely as illness and not at all as identity are starkly evident in the explanation Dr. Karen McCarran gave for suffocating her 3-year-old daughter, Katie, in 2008. She said, "Autism left me hollow. Maybe I could fix her this way, and in heaven she would be complete." One of McCarran's friends said, "Karen never took a night off. She read every book. She was trying so hard." Katie McCarran's paternal grandfather has responded to such rationalizations with indignation. Some newspapers have reported that this was done to end Katie's pain. "Let me assure you that Katie was not in pain," he wrote. "She was a beautiful, precious, and happy little girl. Each day she was showered with love and returned that love with hugs, kisses, and laughter. I am positively revolted when I read quotes that hint at condoning the taking of my granddaughter's life." On another occasion, he said, "If these people are advocates for people with autism, I can't imagine what the opponents must be like." Stephen Drake, research analyst for the organization Not Dead Yet, wrote, "On June 9th, the Chicago Tribune published an article about the McCarran case. The title was, 'Daughter's Murder Puts Focus on Toll of Autism,' making the thrust of the article all too clear. More space was devoted to sympathetic comments about Karen McCarran and the negative comments about autism itself than to description of the victim or comments from deeply grieving family members." Dave Reynolds, editor of Inclusion Daily Express, wrote of such coverage, "In every case, neighbors and family members described the murderer as a lovely, devoted mother. In each case, the murderer was portrayed as a desperate victim of her child's disability and a victim of a social service system that failed to provide enough of the right supports." Reynolds complains that these murders are exploited to secure subsidies for treatment programs and worries that this reinforces the idea that these children are horrible burdens to their parents and to society. "In no way can anyone justify murdering a child, nor sympathize with the killer. Each of these women had infinite alternatives to murder." Others would vehemently disagree that the alternatives available to parents coping with autistic children are infinite. In fact, many parents who eventually turn on their children have first struggled to secure placements that eluded them. Heidi Shelton, who attempted unsuccessfully to kill herself and her 5-year-old son, said, "I can't let Zach live in this world where he is constantly rejected by everyone, including his family, education system, etc." John Victor Cronin, who attempted but failed to kill his 26-year-old son, his wife, and himself, was able to get his son a placement only after his trial. His wife said, "There's nowhere to go until people are almost killed. Then they've got a place for people like Richard." If we feel some measure of responsibility toward these parents, and the outpouring of sympathy that commonly greets these murders suggests that we do, we would serve them and their children far better with more endgame strategies. We need respite care and free and satisfactory residential placements. We need positive narratives of autism that free parents from the compulsion to eliminate the syndrome, even at the cost of eliminating the child. Parents of autistic children are often sleep-deprived. They are frequently impoverished by the cost of care. They are overwhelmed by the unrelenting needs of children who often require constant supervision, They may be divorced and isolated. They may spend endless hours fighting their insurance and health providers and the local education authority that determines what services their child will get. They may forfeit their jobs because they miss so many days to deal with crises. They often have poor relationships with their neighbors because their children destroy property or are violent. Stress leads people to extreme acts. Extreme stress leads people beyond our most profound social taboo, the slaughter of one's own child. Some claim to kill their autistic children out of love, and some acknowledge hate or anger. Deborah L. Whitson, who attempted to kill her son, told police by way of explanation, "I waited 11 years to hear him say, 'I love you, Mom.'" Passion is confusing, and most of these parents act out of emotion so overpowering that to identify it as either love or hate is to reduce it. They themselves do not know what they are feeling. They know only how much they feel it. More than half of the children murdered in the United States are killed by their parents, and about half of those parents claim to have acted altruistically. Societal acceptance of that label, however, has been shown to have a toxic effect. Criminologists consistently report that the use of the word altruism by bioethicists increases not only the number of filicides, but also the frequency of abuse, disinhibiting parents who are already inclined toward violence. Copycat episodes commonly follow high-profile cases in which the altruism motive is endorsed. FBI profilers have argued that in many such killings, the real motive is the need for power and control. Courtroom leniency sends a message to the society at large, to other parents, and to people with autism that autistic lives are less valuable than other lives. This line of reasoning comes perilously close to eugenics. Chapter 6. Schizophrenia. The trauma of Down syndrome is that it is present prenatally and can therefore undermine the early stages of bonding. The challenge of autism is that it sets in or is detected in the toddler years, and so transfigures the child to whom parents have already bonded. The shock of schizophrenia is that it manifests in late adolescence or early adulthood, and parents must accept that the child they have known and loved for more than a decade may be irrevocably lost, even as that child looks much the same as ever. Initially, parents almost universally believe that schizophrenia is invasive, an added layer masking their beloved child, who must somehow be liberated from its temporary conquest. The more likely reality is that schizophrenia, like Alzheimer's, is an illness not of accrual, but of replacement and deletion. Rather than obscuring the previously known person, this disease to some degree eliminates that person. Yet vestiges persist, most notably in the doggedness of personal history, for the person with schizophrenia will recall events of a childhood in which mental illness played no apparent role. He will tell his parents the things they did right and tried to do right, as well as any history of trauma. He will know his cousins by name and will preserve certain skills, a mean backhanded tennis, perhaps, or the ability to raise a single eyebrow in surprise or disdain. He may sustain other continuities, a sense of humor, a dislike of broccoli, a love of autumn sunlight, a preference for rollerball pens. He may retain his most basic aspects of character, including kindness. The betrayal of schizophrenia is its irrational juxtaposition of things that vanish and things that don't. Schizophrenia can take away the ability to connect to or love or trust another person, the full use of rational intelligence, the capacity to function in any professional context, the basic faculty of physical self-care, and large areas of self-awareness and analytic clarity. Most famously, the schizophrenic disappears into an alternative world of voices that he erroneously perceives to be external. These internally generated relationships become far more real and important than any interaction with the authentically outside world. The voices are usually cruel and often encourage bizarre and inappropriate behavior. The person who hears them is commonly terrified and almost always paranoid. Sometimes the hallucinations are visual and olfactory as well, and make a world full of actual threats into a writhing hell of inescapable terrorization. Though many schizophrenics become curiously attached to their delusions, the fading of the non-delusional world puts them in loneliness beyond all reckoning, a fixed residence on a noxious private planet they can never leave and where they can receive no visitors. Between 5% and 13% of people with schizophrenia commit suicide. In some sense, though, that is the least of it. A woman whose schizophrenic brother committed suicide said, "Eventually, Mama got over Roger's death, but she never got over his life." Few things could be worse than perceiving your dreams as true. We all know that lovely relief of stretching out to welcome a new day, free of shadow horrors that came in slumber. Psychosis is a gross disturbance in an individual's ability to distinguish self from reality. For schizophrenics, the membrane between imagination and reality is so porous that having an idea and having an experience are not particularly different. In the earlier stages of illness, schizophrenics often have symptoms of depression, because psychosis itself is distressing, and because of the desperate nature of schizophrenic thought. This is the time of greatest suicide risk. In later stages, emotional capacity altogether is reduced, and people may seem vacant and emotionless. Interviewing schizophrenics, I was struck by the way those deep in the disease seemed not to feel self-pity, which contrasted sharply with my experience of people with depression and other psychiatric disorders, a frequently whiny group to which I myself belong. People in the early stages were horrified and sad, but those who had been sick a long time were not. They complained about particular delusions or felt guilty not to be functioning better, but there was surprisingly little railing at the disease itself. Many had once been headed for wonderful lives, but the woman who had been a great beauty seemed, unlike her parents, not to think about the adventures in love she would have had. A sweet-natured fellow who had been wildly popular in high school could not tell me, as his parents could, how much pleasure a lifetime of friendships might have given him. A man who excelled at Harvard at the time of his first psychotic break never talked, as his parents did, about the career he had so narrowly missed. It seemed that illness had cut these schizophrenics off from those lives so entirely that they were hardly conscious of them. They had stoic grace in relation to their illness, and I was consistently moved by it. The first time I met Harry Watson, he undermined my perceptions of schizophrenia. Impossibly good-looking at age 38, he had such a pleasant and open expression and such an easy and amusing way of speaking that I would not have known anything was wrong if I hadn't been told ahead of time. He was at a party thrown by his accomplished half-sister Pamela and had come with his naturally elegant, casually intelligent mother, Kitty, and the three of them seemed like they could have been extras in the Philadelphia Story. "I think he always hopes it will be more fun than it turns out to be for him," Kitty said to me later. "He starts sweating a lot. He could barely get out of bed the next day." Pamela and Harry share Kitty as their mother. Harry has two other half-sisters via his father, Bill. The only boy and the youngest of the four, Harry was born in 1969 in California, much indulged and doted on. He was a wonderful baseball player, Kitty said. When he was about 10, he said the coach had asked him to be pitcher. Harry said, "I don't think I could handle that kind of pressure." Doesn't that sound strange from a 10-year-old? He has told me that even at that age, he felt like there was something wrong. Pamela, a novelist and journalist, said, "You hear this story a lot, but he was a golden boy. He was a great athlete, charismatic, the one everyone copied. Then my mother and his father, my stepfather, divorced when he was 12, the same year I left for college. The message he had heard all along from his father was that you don't show weakness. Instead of admitting that he felt weird, Harry just hid it. Until he finished high school, Harry still had friends and seemed like a normal teenager. He presents as much better than he is, so even since his diagnosis, his therapists have picked up much less than they should have," Kitty said. "He still thinks that if he acts like he's normal, he'll be treated more normally by the world. All it means is that he doesn't get as much help as he needs." We had no idea what was going on for a long time, so we didn't take steps to find him proper treatment, Pamela said. The results were catastrophic. He was in the hands of this greedy, incompetent, unethical shrink my stepfather had found, and none of us realized how bad that situation was. It broke Harry's heart to find that this guy was a charlatan, something he could see only many years in hospitalizations down the road. And he was never able to trust another therapist that way. Recognizing psychosis can be a gradual project. "For years, I would instantly forget things Harry said and did that were just not right," Pamela said. "The year I was 24 and he was 18, he became very depressed and secretive, and my mother convinced me to come home for Christmas to talk to him. We shut the door to his room and didn't emerge for 6 hours. He told me that everyone thought he was gay. He was convinced that his girlfriend thought he was gay, that all of his friends thought he was gay, that my mother and his father thought he was gay. I said, 'That's ridiculous. No one thinks you're gay.' That was a revelation, and he seemed to be freed, and I felt very good about having helped him." Taking a step back, that was a very complicated, prolonged delusion. He really needed serious treatment. Harry enrolled in Rollins College and majored in philosophy and studied psychology, clearly trying to understand what was happening to him, Kitty said. The next Christmas, Pamela and Harry went to Palm Springs to join Harry's father and his other children. Harry was incredibly hostile, Pamela said. One night, he suddenly announced that he had taken acid with one of my stepsisters. He discovered on this LSD trip that his brain always is that way. That's basically a declaration of schizophrenia. Still, despite the little episodes of weirdness through his college graduation in 1992, Harry seemed to be holding on. 4 years after graduation, he became full-on psychotic for the first time, terrified of his own thoughts. He went into Langley Porter Psychiatric Hospital in San Francisco in the spring of 1996. "We started playing Scrabble because it's hard to know what to talk about with someone that crazy," Kitty said. He was pointing to a van in the street, saying that's where the FBI had their equipment. He thought the nurses were trying to poison him, and he didn't want to take medication. I went to his apartment after he was hospitalized, and it was in complete chaos, like a reflection of the inside of his head. Harry was in Langley Porter for 10 days. When he came out, he found a job in computer programming. It went well for a while, and then he was saying his apartment was bugged, Kitty said. He had stopped taking one of his medications. I said, why don't you come over here for the night? He said, your house is bugged too. I'll show you where the transmitters are. So he takes me down to the laundry room and points to where he says the stuff is. I hauled him off to Langley Porter again, and this happened on and off for years. Within 3 days of his leaving the hospital each time, you could feel the self-deception growing thicker and thicker. The war was being lost. Unfortunately, by then, the voices had a grip on him, Pamela said. How can you compete when they're piping in there 24 hours a day? It is so critical that parents of kids with mental illness see it early. If we had realized when he was 15 that something was wrong, who knows what we could have done? It wasn't until he was 30 that he was finally helpless enough, freaked out enough, convinced enough that he was back in our hands for treatment. Kitty experienced that year as a descent into deepening hell. His father had a place in Napa, she said. Harry went there for a weekend in 1997 and never left. After almost a year, I showed up one day, and when he saw me, he screamed, "What the hell are you doing here?" like he was possessed by some demon. I said, "Your dad and I feel that you need to come back to the city, start seeing a doctor regularly, live at home with me, and get on medication." He said, "I'm not going to." I said, "If you don't, we're throwing you out, and you're going to be on the streets." I was terrified that he would take me up on that, and I had found a private eye to follow him around so that nothing bad would happen to him. A private eye to shadow someone with a paranoid delusion that he was being tracked by the FBI. He screamed how he hated me. 48 hours later, he moved home. Pamela remembered, Harry also has a drinking problem, and in Napa, he just drank, I mean, bottles of tequila, until he blacked out. It's amazing he's alive. Then drinking would make him incredibly depressed. That's when he would drive to the Golden Gate Bridge, and sometimes stand right on it, thinking about whether to jump. He says he came very close once, but he's not a risk-taker, so he's less suicidal than you would expect. In the months that followed Napa, Kitty found it a great relief to have Harry back at home, but also a constant stress to see him lost in his madness. I would be bringing people in the house, and I never knew when he might emerge, Kitty said. He often went off his meds and had to be rehospitalized. I would look around his room. It was the reverse of people who are addicts. If I didn't see any bottles, I was really worried. He soon moved back to his own apartment. I would go ring the bell, and he wouldn't answer, so I'd let myself in, Kitty said. I had to go up a very steep staircase, and he would loom at the top. I was pretty sure he wouldn't push me down the stairs, but he would scream, and it was scary. Pamela said, he was hugely fat, incredibly hostile and angry, and didn't believe a word anyone said. His disdain was so evident that it was terrible to talk to him. He was becoming like Jim Morrison in his later years, holed up in the house, filling salad bowls with pasta, and eating them in front of the television set. It was hard to imagine him functioning in any way, shape, or form. 3 years after Napa, when Harry was 32, Kitty wanted to give him a fresh start, and she chose McLean, the mental hospital affiliated with Harvard, as the place to do it. Getting him out of San Francisco and to McLean was an amazing achievement, Pamela said. I still don't quite know how my mother did that. He was so ensconced in his little hole in San Francisco, and she had to persuade him to go along with it, because she didn't have any legal power to make him do it. Harry was admitted as a long-term inpatient. He began new meds and started working with the therapist he has seen ever since. Harry, who is not tall, weighed 220 pounds. The doctors convinced him that this was neither smart nor healthy, and after about 6 months, he put himself on a diet and started running. Other patients would hum the theme from Rocky as he went sprinting across McLean's grassy campus. "It was hard lugging all that blubber around," Kitty said. "Suddenly it dawned on me, why isn't there a fitness center there?" Kitty raised the money to build one. Harry helped pick out the equipment. Kitty's motivation was partly that she believes in fitness, but it also gave her an excuse to be in and out of the hospital without Harry's perceiving that she was constantly checking up on him. The fitness center now receives some 700 visits a month. Harry has lost 60 pounds since he went to McLean. "He runs every day," Pamela said. "He talks of having an illness." "Frankly, if you had presented me with this scenario before he left San Francisco, it would have seemed like an impossibly upbeat outcome." But the years between his first hints of psychosis and McLean have taken their toll. Not only was their time lost, but also the brain's not what it was after 15 years of psychosis, Pamela explained. "He's a very damaged guy, but you can see how smart, articulate, and amusing he is, and what an interesting and dynamic life he might have had. He's sick enough that he can't really do anything, but well enough that he understands how much he's missing. He's well enough to know that he shouldn't tell other people the voices are real, but not well enough to believe it himself. He told me he was worried that the board was going to make these terrible decisions about him. I said, 'God, the thing about these voices that's so unimpressive is how boring and dumb they are. I mean, the board? The cheesiest TV show could do better.' Then we can laugh. He and I also discuss a real hurdle he has not overcome, which is that he doesn't really want to stop listening to them. Even though they scare him, they've been friends." Kitty said simply, "Harry is having a tough time deciding whether he wants to be in the real world or that other world." Harry now lives on his own in an apartment in Cambridge. He runs every day for an hour, watches television, and goes to a lot of movies and coffee shops. He sees his therapist. He's interested in fish and has a saltwater and a freshwater tank. He also had a job working in a greenhouse that is part of McLean's vocational program. But in Harry's world, nothing is stable for long, and on one of my later visits with Kitty, she revealed that he had stopped going to the greenhouse. "His world has plateaued at the smallness that it's at," she said. Kitty wears herself down with the relentless quest to help Harry up, and though she has been more successful than anyone could have hoped, her restless frustration takes a toll. "Having my own children was very freeing," Pamela said, "because I just couldn't live and breathe this every day." While she was saying this to me, Pamela put her cell phone on the table between us. "I have this as much for him as for my kids. He calls me when he's feeling deluded and needs to be talked out of it. I know that if I'm not hearing from him, things are okay." Kitty recognizes the advantages to this situation, but is also frustrated by it. "I had hoped Pamela would be more involved," she said. At the same time, Kitty feels that she should shoulder as much of Harry's care as she can, for as long as she can. He's very lonely, but as soon as anybody tries to befriend him, he starts to have paranoid thoughts about them, she said. "He told me he went running, and this guy says, 'Harry, Harry.' It's the guy who makes pancakes in the diner where he goes. They talked for a while. 'I felt like I was a member of a community,' he said." But Harry and his mother also joke. Kitty has kept a hand in at McLean by redesigning inpatient rooms. Harry said to her, "Gee, Ma, It looks like I've brought you a whole new career opportunity. Finding the balance between encouragement and pressure remains almost impossible.